A poet bears witness to disaster.
Because of my own, the forces that have shaped me in life, I've always been concerned, I think, in some ways about bearing witness to disaster more generally, and particularly how women have done so.
That's Deborah Paredes. We talk with her about her stunning new poetry collection, Year of the Dog. Then, what do the epic failures attending the coronavirus pandemic in the U.S. show us about our society?
It is quite clear that most of our existing institutions, both corporations, banks, private entities, but also many of our public institutions, including the way that the state is set up today, have really reached the end of their ability to provide.
That's Vincent D'Emanuele. We talk with him about his article in Counterpunch, The New Normal. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. In a time of crisis like our current pandemic, poetry becomes essential to our survival. Nothing illustrates this better than the poetry of Deborah Paredes. In her new poetry collection, Year of the Dog, Paredes witnesses with a spare and eloquent ferocity the injustices of our time and the courage of those who contest them. Former U.S. Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey said of the book, "Here, what it means to contend with grief, to live in the aftermath of national and personal trauma, the casualties and collateral damage of war and injustice, is in the hands of an unflinching witness." Paredes' view is both intensely personal and broad, historical, contextual. Today, we get to hear her read her poems and discuss them. It's a real treat. Deborah Paredes is a poet and scholar whose lectures and publications examine Black and Latinx popular culture, poetry of war and witness, feminist elegy, and cultural memory. She's co-founder and co-director of Canto Mundo, a national organization for Latinx poets, and is a professor at Columbia University. Well, Deborah Paredes, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. It's just really a pleasure to be here, reaching out across the ways during this moment.
This is just an incredible poetry collection, Year of the Dog. And in many ways, I was reading it through the lens of the present moment. I wanted to start out, in fact, with the first poem, because I did read it, interestingly enough, through the lens of this moment, even though it really doesn't relate to that. It's called Wife's Disaster Manual. And let's just start out. I'd like to start out by asking you just to read that poem. Wow, that is such a powerful poem. First of all, tell us about your context for that poem when you wrote it, and then maybe how you might think, I know how I think of it, in this time when the cities may not be burning, but they certainly, our society does seem to be collapsing in many ways.
Thank you so much for asking that question. It's a poem that initially started, I think that because of my own, the forces that have shaped me in life, I've always been concerned, I think in some ways, about bearing witness to disaster more generally, and particularly how women have done so. And so I had reread this, or come into contact once again with the story of Lot's wife, and was very interested, as I am in much of my work, in kind of reworking from a feminist perspective, the idea of her turning back to look at the city, right? And what if we thought about turning back to look at the city, not because she was somehow too attached to her material life there, in a kind of, way that was marked by avarice or greed, but instead what it meant to kind of turn around and refuse to look away, right? And to bear witness to that, which is consumed by disaster. And so that poem I wrote initially as a way to kind of work through that. And it's written in a form called Villanelle, which uses a lot of repetition, almost like relentless repetition, which for me really speaks to what you kind of have to do if you're going to bear witness, right? You have to stay, you have to just keep standing there. You have to be relentless and full of resilience, right? In the unflinching way that you can't look away, so to speak, right? Or can't keep speaking about it. And so that was kind of the general context. And I will say that as this moment came upon us, I have been turning back to it, you know, and thinking about, especially being living in New York City as I am, and being fortunate enough, of course, to be at home, but also being among many of us who can't leave the city, right? And or who have chosen not to, if we've had options. What does it mean to actually stand still in this moment, and not just the standing still, not being like hiding out in our isolation and kind of buffering ourselves by it, but in that standing still, looking around and speaking to the horrors.
Could you say more about that? What has it been like for you to stand still and witness?
It's been interesting to feel the range of emotions, right? To stand still means that everything floods in, right? And so just this morning I was writing, I've been corresponding with a friend in Milan, right? Another city that's been devastated. And I was saying to her that, you know, on the one hand, I see that, for example, in my neighborhood, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, where my child has sung in the choir, where I often sought shelter in its, you know, in the Poet's Corner there on a rainy day, you know, our neighborhood cathedral is now going to be transformed into a temporary hospital. In the same moment that I look outside and I see the cherry blossoms like insisting on blooming, right? That you have to be able to hold, I think to sit in it means holding all of that. It means delivering, you know, masks to my neighbors who are older than us, right? It means watching the people who are walking to work, to and from work every day. And at least if I can't physically reach out to them, finding other ways to at least mark that. I do feel like it, you know, it is a moment right now where we are, I think it's highlighting how much responsibility we have to those who are among the most vulnerable in our population, right? Whether it's in terms of age or in terms of, you know, economic vulnerability or otherwise, it's really kind of making that sense of responsibility all the more heightened and clear.
Yes. And also these poems, you know, they really do speak to the issue of social justice. And that's something that's really coming up here, becoming so stark with this pandemic, the huge number of the disproportionate number of cases, but by large percentages of those communities, Latino communities, African American communities, working class communities of all racial backgrounds, of people who must work, who are essential, as this poem refers to, who are so vulnerable as well. So I wanted to actually ask you then about the title "Year of the Dog," because it is connected to you know, largely to poems about moments of the, let's say, the conflict, the rising up of the people against oppression and being met by the oppressor. Talk a little bit about what is the Year of the Dog? Why that title?
Sure. So the title carries a couple of meanings for me, and certainly throughout the book. On the one hand, Year of the Dog refers to the year of my birth, 1970, which was the year of the metal dog in the lunar calendar, and was the year, in addition to the year of my birth, was the year my father was preparing to, was deployed and preparing to go to Vietnam to serve in the war. He, like many working class and newly arrived immigrant Latinos, in his case, Mexican Americans, he was drafted and then ultimately served in Vietnam. The Year of the Dog, though, also for me refers more broadly to the figure of Hecuba in ancient Greek, you know, mythology. Hecuba, who was the queen of Troy and who very famously, in her grief and rage over the horrors of war following the Trojan War, grieved and howled in her grief until she was transformed into a dog. She was being taken by the Greeks back to be a slave to the Greeks. And her transformation into a dog meant that she also like leapt free from potential slavery and like went, you know, sort of into the ocean and then on to, you know, sort of an island where she remained a dog, kind of howling against the ravages of war and committed so fully to her grief and to sort of crying out about it. And so Hecuba and other mythic figures like Lot's wife and in the poem I just read, figure as well throughout the book as kind of voices crying out against the horrors of war and of violence, and particularly those moments in history, which certainly the Vietnam era shows us, but as our current moment shows us as well, wherein, you know, marginal communities, in this case, like poor and working class Latinos, were disproportionately affected by these disasters.
The first poem that you talk about your father does refer to that. It's a show of hands. And I'm struck by, you know, you just mentioned Hecuba who howled. You have a kind of recurring theme of hands, of mouths, of tongues, of feet. Could you first say something about how you root these poems in these parts of the body?
Part of the book includes, among many things, a series of poems, as you mentioned, that are very interested in examining not just more overt physical violence, right, but also the way that language itself can house particular kinds of violence, right? And I wanted to speak to kind of the everydayness of violence that often then inures us to these, you know, these bigger violences. And so I did a series of poems that drew almost exclusively from idioms, which to me is, right, the most kind of mundane form of language, right? Most hackneyed form, you know, the idiom. And I drew exclusively from idioms that used parts of the body, hands, mouths, eyes, backs, tongues. And I wanted to do that as a way to kind of show again how mundane, like how the most mundane form of language can house this violence. And also to kind of make those mundane things as strange, kind of make the everyday strange again, so that we could be almost reacquainted with the horror that is around us every day. And I wanted, in some ways, kind of also visually, to have these body parts, so to speak, strewn throughout the book, right, in the way that war will certainly do that, or any form of violence. And so that was the motivation for those poems, in thinking through how then to put forth the parts of the body, right, or the ways that the body gets sort of torn asunder by war in particular.
Mm. Yeah, and so now could you read A Show of Hands?
A Show of Hands. My father taught me never to show my hand, always play the hand you're dealt. Don't bite the hand that feeds you, gotta hand it to him. He lived his life hand to mouth. Even before Nam, he knew close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades go hand to hand combat. Idle hands are the devil's play into the enemy's hand it over and out of his hands. Ringing a bird in hand is worth two in the bush. He wasn't so good with his hands, took his life into his own blood on his hands, on the one hand and on the other.
Could you say more about that end? I wasn't sure what you were saying there.
About this particular poem, I was very interested in thinking about how, certainly in the case of my father, wanting to convey that even after the war, right, you know, both before the war, but even after, there, the legacy of, you know, what does blood on one's hands mean, right? You know, it means figuratively, right, or in the idiom, right, to kind of, to in the afterwards still have some sense of implication, even as you're drawn into this service, you know, however unwillingly or not, that legacy of violence stays with one. And for me, using the idiom form, kind of, you know, collaging all these idioms together, for me, I was hoping to reinforce, right, that in the everyday, it's still there. The legacies of war kind of emerge in the everyday moments, and through everyday language.
How did you experience that with your father? I mean, I assume he came back from Vietnam, right?
So yes, I was fortunate, right? My father came back. Many in his neighborhood, as I've written before, in an op-ed I published last year, thinking about many people in his neighborhood, which was a mostly immigrant Mexican and Mexican-American neighborhood on the west side of San Antonio, Texas, had actually the second highest fatality rate among its high school in its district, school district in the country, surpassed only by another predominantly Black school district, actually, in the country. So he came from a neighborhood where many people he was surrounded by did not come back. So he did come back from the war. And yet the war kind of came back with him, right? As it did for so many veterans at that time. And I think many people who grew up with the war in their household, as I did, we share a lot of experiences of silence in the house about the war. So there was a kind of verbal silence, which for many reasons is what propelled me, I think, to begin writing at all, was to try to speak into that void. And yet also markers of undiagnosed PTSD, right? So, you know, as I write about in the book, you know, seizures at night that were clearly a response to trauma or the evocation of the lingering trauma. Sometimes, you know, the sense of just a volatility that would be, you know, just kind of everything seemed to be sometimes just a little bit on thin ice, because we all understood there was such an emotional weight in the room that we couldn't quite identify, right? Couldn't quite entirely be named because it was so big. And because, quite honestly, at the time, you know, my parents did try to go to the VA to say, hey, this is going on. You know, I think it has to do with the war. And like many people, they were, you know, initially turned away and said, no, this has nothing to do. There wasn't a kind of general knowledge and an acknowledgement of the sort of the pervasiveness of PTSD. And so I think that also contributed to so much silence among that particular generation.
So true. Silence and violence. My son's father was a Vietnam veteran, was in some of the most terrible battles of the war, and had a problem with violence when he came back. And it wasn't until, you know, long after I had left him because of that violence that he got diagnosed with PTSD and treated.
That's such a common story that I hear, you know, among many, many families, right, who had the war continuing in their household, right, mm-hmm. As I like to say. And I think it's, you know, it's no surprise that many of us who grew up either as children of vets or as children of refugees, you know, I have such an affinity and many friends and fellow writers with whom I'm in contact, you know, we have similar stories, whether it's about that violence, whether it's about our own writing being deeply shaped by that moment because we were trying to speak to that, or those of us who, and as we see in my book, who, because there wasn't anything spoken, we would like try to furtively find the photographs or snapshots our parents took during that time as a way to find answers. And so much of the use of images in my book came out of that early yearning and those early kind of furtive glances of photographs, right, that my father took in the photo album, right, that was sort of stored away in a closet that I would find. You know, I would sort of furtively look at that.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Deborah Paredes about her new collection of poetry, Year of the Dog. Another poem that really struck me, because it was a moment that I remember very well, I lived not very far away from where it happened, is a poem called Lightning. At that time, I was in school in Madison, Wisconsin. This happened in Chicago, Illinois, on the 4th of December, 1969. Tell us about this poem.
Sure. This poem is, again, I think one of the poems in the collection that both combines my emphasis on, you know, the violence and horrors that happened during the Vietnam era with that emphasis on women bearing witness to disaster. And it's a poem about Deborah Johnson, or who's now named Akura Njeri, who was the partner to Fred Hampton, who was a really important figure in the Black Power movement, and who was also killed by the Chicago police and the state on December 4th, 1969. And he was killed. They were together in their apartment. Deborah, at the time, she was 8.5 months pregnant. They were asleep in their bed, and basically the apartment was kind of riddled, was shot through with bullets. And Fred Hampton was murdered right there in bed next to her. And Deborah Johnson was taken from the scene, you know, sort of by the police outside of the apartment. And she later, she in interviews kind of talked about that moment with such power and such clarity that I was very moved by that. You know, I saw interviews in the documentary Eyes on the Prize. I read some of the FBI, you know, statements that she gave. And I was so completely struck by her ability to sort of look to as Lot's wife in my version does, right? Like just to look into the face of disaster at her, you know, her murdered partner and the father of her child to be, and to be able to still tell about it, right, in the most powerful way that she did. And so this poem, Lightning, is about that moment.
Could you read it for us?
Lightning, Chicago, Illinois, December 4th, 1969, for Deborah Johnson, Akua Najeri. You didn't look down or back. Spent the fractured minutes studying each crease and curve of the lawmen's faces. So later you could tell how it happened. How you crossed over his body. How you kept your hands up. How you didn't reach for anything. Not your opened robe. Nothing. How they said he's good and dead. How you crossed over the threshold. How you lifted one and then the other slippered foot across the ice. How you kept yourself from falling. How your bared belly bore the revolver's burrowing snout. How when the baby starts to descend, it's called lightning, though it feels like a weight you cannot bear. Lightning is when you know it won't be long before it's over.
Yeah, another just incredibly powerful. In fact, I went to read some of her, to read what happened after I read this poem, and it's so evocative. I mean, it's so true, this poem, to what I read, even though, you know, the details certainly fill out the story in a different way, but this really expresses the emotion that one, or that I felt in reading what actually happened to her. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Then there are a couple more Year of the Dog poems, actually two that are really paired with each other. Year of the Dog, Synonyms for Aperture. This is from Kent State University, the 4th of May, 1970, a day I remember extremely well, and something that followed soon after that, and that was a similar thing that happened in Jackson State. So tell us about those two poems, and why are they part of the Year of the Dog series in this collection, Year of the Dog?
So as the title of the collection suggests, you know, it is a book in many ways about the Year of the Dog, right? Or that particular Year of the Dog. And in 1970, I was interested in documenting not just kind of the origins of my own coming into being, but in documenting historically kind of, you know, much of what was happening during that moment in history, you know, the occupation of Alcatraz, the horrific violence that happened on campuses, certainly across the country, but most notably at Kent State and at Jackson State College. You know, we're coming upon the 50th anniversary, right, in this coming May will be the 50th anniversary for these events. And I also wrote many of these poems actually in 2018, which was another Year of the Dog, in which it was also the notable for the extraordinarily horrific number of campus or school shootings that year. There were more people who died in school shootings than in like actually at war, you know, in our country sort of deployed at war that year. And so I was very interested in kind of going back to those moments. And in particular, with regards to Kent State, I was very interested as well, as the book does, in having us re-examine our relationship to the very iconic images from that era, right? The Kent State photo, you know, all we have to say is the Kent State photo. And many of us, at least of a certain age, can complete, and even those I think younger can evoke that image, right? There's certain images from that era, because it was, you know, unrestricted access was given to many photographers, both in Vietnam and here. It was a war that was very much sort of known for its at least certain kinds of documentation, or hyper photographic documentation. And so I wanted us to kind of, again, re-examine our relationship to that photo and how to kind of make its horrors fresh to us again. We've become inured in some ways to some of them. So these two poems, I hope, speak to that. So the first one, Year of the Dog, Synonyms for Aperture, Kent State University, May 4th, 1970. Marianne Vecchio is down on her knees. Jeffrey Miller's body is face down beside her. John Philo presses his finger down and the aperture shutters. There are four down when the shooting stops. Marianne's arms are outstretched, a stripped mast. John is running out of film. Snowy blossoms shroud the dogwoods outside the frame. This girl came up and knelt over the body and let out a god-awful scream, John will say. That made me click the camera. Marianne is a 14-year-old runaway. Later, she'll say, I hitchhiked my way into history, and later, it really destroyed my life. There will be a song about four dead in Ohio. Oh, hi, oh, I, oh, oh, oh. The bullet enters Jeffrey's opened mouth and comes out the other side. Marianne's mouth is open, an obliterated star. Synonyms for aperture: mouth, gap, cleft, chasm, hole, ruptured, perforated passage. I. In Spanish images of the Pietà, the Virgin often holds out one hand or the other. Marianne will get hate mail. Mary, you dirty tramp, it's too bad it wasn't you that was shot. Or another, you hippie communist bitch, did you enjoy sleeping with all those dope fiends and Negroes when you were in Ohio? Marianne's mother will say, can you imagine her looking at that?
And that really struck me, the way you ended that, because Marianne is the witness, and then it's the photo of the witness, and the Pietà image is so apt there. And then one frame further out is you see her mother witnessing her daughter and thinking, you know, I mean, I can only imagine thinking what is happening to my daughter that she had to witness this.
Yeah. Absolutely. And in some ways, you know, for me also, the way I broke the line and the last line is imagine her looking at that, it becomes for me as well a directive to the reader, right? Like, yes, do that imagining, right? Make that particular kind of leap that then leads us toward a kind of politics of witnessing as well.
Right. And so then there's Jackson State. I mean, so many people remember Kent State, but Jackson State happened not long after that. Tell us what happened and then read the poem if it's not too long for you.
So the 10 days after Kent State, the historically black college, Jackson State College at the time, you know, had been peaceably protesting, right? The, you know, an anti-war demonstrations, and like many places across the country at the time. And, you know, it was Jackson State College was, you know, in a town that was notoriously hostile, right, to many of the black students on campus. And they had demonstrated, and in response, you know, huge numbers of National Guard came in and basically shot up the women's dormitory. There was sort of some word that somehow that's where demonstrations were going to happen. And there were no actual shots fired from within the dormitory. There was only, I think, a wine bottle that got dropped. And then that was pretty much it. If you look at the evidence afterwards and looking at kind of where the bullets were coming from, all of them came from outside of the dormitory into the dormitory. And there's a photographs that were taken afterwards by a number of photos. There's one by Jack Thornell has a photograph of two unarmed women looking that who were dorm students looking out of the window frame afterwards. That was an extraordinarily moving photo to me, where they're just looking out at this sort of completely shot up and all the windows have been sort of shot out. And so I was very moved by, again, this image of women kind of looking back out of this frame, and what might they have been thinking or seeing. So this poem is called Year of the Dog, Aftermath. Jackson State College, May 14th and 15th, 1970. For as long as folks can remember, the campus has been split by Lynch Street, the four-lane thoroughfare leading back to town. The stoplights flashing red at the intersection of Lynch and any street it meets, making it so townsfolk can idle and rev their engines, cussing the dark students trying to cross. It's not long before the National Guardsmen march down, before the city police march up, before the students hear, "We're going to kill some of you, Nick," before the thrum and bleat that follows. Some students crouch under dorm room desks. Some students are running away. Some students stand still. Some students are falling down. Some students climb the stairs. Some students are screaming. Some students make no sound. Some students stay inside. Some students are bleeding out. Some students are bowing their heads over equations, finding the value of each variable, drawing lines that intersect in the shape of a cross or an X. If 100 students peaceably gathered, if 647 National Guardsmen on duty in Jackson, Mississippi, if 40 highway patrolmen, if 27 city police, if greater than 200 rounds fired, if 460 buckshots fired, if 28 seconds of gunfire, if 140 bullet marks on Alexander Women's Dormitory, if 24 windows into which shots are fired, if 18 metal panels pocked with buckshot, if one wine bottle dropped from a dormitory window, if zero shots fired from inside the dormitory, if zero windows left unshattered by gunfire, then 17-year-old James Earl Green is dead, then 21-year-old Philip Lafayette Gibbs is dead, then 12 more students hospitalized, then one photograph of the shattered facade, then one bullet branded not twisted white curtain still hanging on. Then two dark faces of the risen women looking out of the pain emptied frame.
A real incantation, a real elegy.
Thank you. That was the goal. So I'm glad that's how you heard it.
Yeah. Well, Deborah Paredes, I'd like to end with a self-portrait. Now, self-portrait is another theme in this wonderful collection of poems. I wish we had time to hear many more of them. But I wonder if you could end with self-portrait with weeping women, because this comes back to some of the things we've already spoken about, witness and Hecuba and you. So if you could read that poem, first talk about that poem and then read it.
The book does have a number of self-portraits. It's playing a lot with kind of what we call in poetry the ekphrastic, right, where you're writing a poem about, you know, works of art. And so self-portrait becomes in some ways part of the aesthetic, I guess, of the book. And this poem, as you know, as I've mentioned before, really does, I think, try to speak to some of the origins of how this book came to be, right? That how from early on, I really did identify with women who would, you know, weep and kind of cry out about, you know, loss and kind of committed themselves to grief. I grew up Mexican-American, you know, in Texas, and there was always the folktale of La Llorona. She was often used as a cautionary tale, like, don't go outside at night, you know, La Llorona will get you. La Llorona, who is the woman who lost her children and roamed the riverbanks crying out for them, right? And so this poem, it's a sonnet that really tries to kind of speak to that. Self-portrait with weeping women. I know why I fell hard for Hecuba. Shins skinned and lips split to blooming lupine on her throat's rough coat, hurled down the whole length of disaster. I'm sure I'd grown to know by then to slacken as a sail against the current and squall of a woman's woe. What could I do but chorus my ruddered howl to hers? When you're a brown girl raised up near the river, there's always a woman bereft and bankrupt, bloodied and bleeding her insistent lament. Ay, Llorona. Every crossing is a tomb and a tune, a wolf wail and the moon that turns me to scratch at the tracks of every mud-dirged girl.
Well, David Paredes, thank you so much for talking with us about this beautiful collection of poems. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca. It was a real pleasure.
Deborah Paredes. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about her work. Next up, is electoral politics broken? Is it time to focus more on grassroots movement building? We talk with activist and Iraq War veteran Vincent Emanuele. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed deep fissures and failures in our society. The catastrophe of our private healthcare system, privileging profit over the preparation for disaster. The cruel inequities that condemn the poor, homeless, prisoners, and above all, black and brown people to much higher risk of death from the virus. And the flagrant disregard for the safety of essential workers by corporate owners. And that's just a start. We've seen our voting system being discarded as an afterthought by the Supreme Court and state legislatures from Wisconsin to New York. We've seen a presidency and a Congress who care more for the economic well-being of the privileged few, them that got, than the people they were elected to serve, those who are losing their livelihoods. It's a bipartisan, epic fail. In his April 9th article for Counterpunch, The New Normal, Cascading and Multi-Layered Crises, Vincent Emanuele explores the roots of our institutional meltdown, the current situation, dire prospects for the future, and how the left should respond. Vincent Emanuele is a writer, activist, and Iraq War veteran. We called him up to talk more with him about his article. Well, Vincent Emanuele, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I was really struck by your article in Counterpunch, The New Normal, Cascading and Multi-Layered Crises. You really put the current crises that we are in the greater context. But I first want to ask you about how you began the piece. You quote from Antonio Gramsci, where you say, "The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear." Tell us a little bit about that quote and why you chose it.
I used that quote for a couple of reasons. One, because I think it describes this moment very clearly. In other words, we're going through massive changes. Capitalism as we know it, neoliberalism as we know it, has really been laid bare during this crisis. And we see the limitations of electoral politics. We see the limitations of even charity or our existing infrastructure, existing healthcare systems, the private healthcare system, and so forth. Even our sort of national logistical capacity. But I think it's really more of an, it gets to the core of what I think the predicament is right now, which is that it is quite clear that most of our existing institutions, both corporations, banks, private entities, but also many of our public institutions, including the way that the state is set up today, have really reached the end of their ability to provide for people to the extent that they could in the first place. And so I think we're watching those systems fail. We're watching the end of a neoliberal era, but we're still in this period where we're not quite sure where we're going to go. We don't have, and when I say we, I mean the left, doesn't really have a vehicle to get us to a new place. And I'm not quite sure, to be quite honest with you, if we even have a vision of what that place may be. I think we have basic ideas. You know, I think there's people who are interested in ideas around democratic socialism, but I also have many left friends who are anarchists or don't identify as anything. And so I think this is a very interesting time to see, as the old dies, how is it? And it's not just sort of proposing that this is something that can't happen, but that this is where we find ourselves now. The old is dying. We don't necessarily have an alternative to replace that. And so this is where we find ourselves today. And in this context, the old system really starts to show itself as being a decrepit, brutal, oppressive, repressive entity that continues to sort of lash out and incapable of providing what people need in a pandemic.
Yeah, in fact, you say that the pandemic has laid bare the hollowness and brutality of global capitalism, and you source it back to Reaganism, which I found very telling. I mean, I've always thought that what Reagan accomplished was a kind of counter-revolution to the New Deal and to the rise of, you know, greater equality in the U.S. So maybe just briefly take us back to Reaganism, and how did it transform this country and set the seeds for what we are reaping today?
Well, if you look at the post-1960 era, I mean, there's a couple of sort of scopes through which I view that period. One is what you just mentioned, which is that Reagan and Thatcher come to power after in 1979, 1980, after a wave of progressive activism and organizing through the 1960s and 70s. And I also view it as a sort of counter-revolutionary force and one of the most dangerous ideological forces, and we can kind of get into that. But it also comes around at a period when the so-called golden era of capitalism, the golden age of capitalism. So here we're looking at the end of World War II, so the late 1940s, all the way into the sort of mid-1970s. And this was a period where you saw poor and working class people able to buy homes, getting good wages and so forth, production expanding. All of that starts to slow down tremendously as profit margins shrink in the 1970s. And of course, this is when the neoliberal period really takes shape. So we're not just talking about sort of a political force, an ideological counter-revolutionary force in the mode of Reagan and Thatcher. We're also, in many ways, looking at the sort of end of a golden era of capitalism, as it's called for people in the United States, but indeed around the globe. And that period from the late 1940s through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people have to remember that virtually every other country in the world was destroyed after World War II. The only country that was left somewhat intact, in fact, primarily intact, was the United States. So we didn't have economic competition in many ways for three decades. And global capitalism in the 1970s and, you know, shrinking profits, people then, of course, what are workers and people in the United States given? They're given credit cards. You know, unions are busted. Public services are starting to be privatized by the late 1970s. We see cities like New York becoming insolvent. I think a great depiction of this period is articulated by the British filmmaker Adam Curtis in his movie Hypernormalization. But it's a great recap of where Trump came from, what that period of sort of the inception of neoliberalism looked like, and then, of course, manifesting in the form of Reaganism and Thatcherism in the 1980s. And of course, I wasn't alive during that period. So for someone like myself, I'm 35 years old. I was born in 1984. My birthday's next month, so I'll be 36 pretty soon. And one of the points I try and make throughout that article is there's an entire generation of people like myself who grew up in and only know a post-Reaganism world. We don't remember massive social movements of the 1960s and 70s. I mean, we've seen some of them during the Bush era, even during the Clinton era with the anti-globalization movement, during the Obama era with Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter, during the Trump era, not so much. But, you know, people who are my age, and I'll just finish by saying this, we grew up, I was born in 1984. I grew up in a Reaganism world. We don't have any recollection of the federal government doing anything positive for people. There's not one major government program that you can name that my generation has benefited from in the last 40 years. And that's, this is where today we find ourselves, where you have an extreme distrust of the existing political parties of Wall Street, capitalism, and so forth. People distrust the media. And I think there's good reason for all of that. And of course, right now, one of the reasons we've had a hard time, I think, coming up with an alternative or a replacement for neoliberal capitalism is because that model of Reaganism has really shattered social society. And so that hyper-individualism, that hyper-materialism has really atomized people at a time when we need collectivity now more than ever. And so the people who grew up in my era, the people who are from my generation, we grew up in what is likely to be the most selfish, materialistic, vapid, banal period in American history, at least that I can find in modern history.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Vincent Emanuele about his piece for Counterpunch, The New Normal, Cascading and Multilayered Crises. And yet there seems to be an incredible renaissance of really good thinking on the left. You have Jacobin Magazine, you have Current Affairs. Just before I spoke to you this morning, I was on a call with the Long Island Mutual Aid organization that has just sprung up out of the most people, I think, are involved with the Democratic Socialists of America, you know, sprung up to create the new world within the ashes of the old. And I have been profoundly impressed as a person who was part of the mass movements of the 1960s and 70s. I have been really impressed by the maturity, savvy, and complexity of thinking, the real kind of very advanced understanding of mobilization among people your age and younger.
I agree. It's an interesting contradiction. So on the one end, when I first got engaged, so just to give your listeners a little background, so I grew up in a sort of union family, very class conscious family, didn't grow up with sort of any kind of intersectional understanding of injustices and so forth, but, you know, grew up in that kind of a household, ended up joining the Marine Corps. Long story short, I'm sent to Iraq with the United States Marine Corps. I'm sent on a second deployment, become politicized during my involvement in the war in Iraq. Come home from my second deployment and refuse orders for a third deployment and immediately joined Iraq Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace. This is back in 2005, 2006. And at that time, there were hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people around the country who were mobilized. But when I compare and contrast the sort of political rhetoric and discourse that was taking place within movements and then in 2006 compared to the sort of conversations that I see today, they are, I agree with you, far more sophisticated today than they were, at least in my anecdotal experience in 2006. And of course, this is articulated, I think, in some ways through the Bernie Sanders campaign. But I think that's where the contradiction comes into play. So at the same time that the left has more media outlets like Jacobin, Real News Network, Democracy Now!, so on and so forth, that have a wider reach than ever before, and that the politics are becoming more and more acceptable to people. So those left, democratic, socialist, even quasi-socialist policies are now more, they're received much more positively from majority of Americans today than they were 14, 15 years ago. Yet we have been incapable of mobilizing people at the scale that we were able to mobilize people, not only during the Bush era, but also I would argue during the Obama era. And yes, there were mobilizations under Trump early on in his term in the White House, but they fizzled out quickly and they weren't necessarily able to translate themselves to progressive political electoral victories in 2018. The Democrats did take the House back, but largely with moderate sort of centrist Democrats from the suburbs. And they weren't able, we weren't able to transfer that energy and power into a successful electoral campaign with Bernie Sanders. That's not to say, and I say this as someone who's spent an inordinate amount of time on that campaign over the last 6 to 8 months, We've devoted all of our time and energy into the campaign. We have a community center here in Michigan City, Indiana, and we have been using it almost exclusively for that campaign over the last several months. And so we went all in with the Bernie campaign, but we found once again that there were less people who were engaged this time around than were engaged in 2016. So I live in Michigan City, Indiana, about 45 miles east of Chicago. It's a somewhat rural county, but I live in a city that's almost one-third Black. We have 33,000 people in the city. It's quite diverse. It's a working-class community. And back in 2016, I was going to house parties, people I'd never had met, 30, 40, 50 people in a house somewhere in LaPorte County, Indiana, having a house party for Bernie. This time around, we were lucky if we could get 10, 15, 20 Bernie members or 20 Bernie supporters in the same room at the same time. And so while some things have moved in a more positive direction, I do think there's contradictions here. And I think exploring those and sort of coming up with what alternatives would be, how would we draw out these folks in the United States who identify with these policies, but who obviously are not interested in solely participating in politics through electoral efforts or namely through the Democratic Party? I think those are real questions that we have to ask in the aftermath of the primary campaign.
I think this is really does go to the heart of the matter for so many of us who are thinking about where to go from here. I mean, there is much in your article that analyzes how we got here. But perhaps the more important question is, where are we going? How do we move away from that interregnum in which a great variety of morbid symptoms appear? For example, I think it's wonderful how you say the as empires decline, so does the quality of their leaders. And I think, you know, we're seeing that in a very bipartisan way. And I guess that's part of what I would ask you. I mean, does it seem to you that the structural, the institutional dead weight of the establishment perforce squeezes out the vitality of popular movements? And if so, is there any place for electoral politics? I mean, I think a lot of people do feel that, and yet it seems to be a kind of Sisyphean task.
So there's two ways I try to approach this. I mean, in the one way, ideologically speaking, I'm probably just opposed to it. At this stage in the game, I look at where we're at. I look at the levels of electoral participation. I anecdotally look at the kind of conversations and experiences I've had through electoral efforts. And I ask myself fundamentally whether or not parliamentarism, electoralism is in any way, shape, or form, the route through which we will achieve the kind of things that that our movements would like to achieve. As time goes on, I'm convinced less and less that that's the case. And I'm also convinced less and less that simply creating third, fourth, or fifth parties will be the answer as well. I think one of the points to make here is that it's not just the structural dead weight of the existing political parties, but that it's the existing dead weight of the entire electoral system. What do we mean by that? We mean not just campaign finance reform and everything that's happened in the sort of post-Citizens United world, and not just gerrymandering, and not just kicking voters off the rolls. All of those things, of course, add to this horrific experience that has become electoral politics in the United States. But we have also found in the United States just the limitations of the electoral college, how undemocratic the system is to its core, the fact that the Supreme Court and other entities in the legal system will do everything in their power to protect corporate interests. I think there's a real question to be asked whether or not we have the ability to accomplish progressive left reforms within our existing electoral system. And again, I say this as someone who hasn't seen any major progressive reforms take place through the legislative process during the course of my entire life, going on almost four decades now. And so I think you have people out there who want to create a third or fourth party. The question I have, knowing that this is all taking place within the context of runaway climate change and broader ecological devastation, my question for activists and organizers is, in a very practical way, so totally non-ideological, how much time do you think it would take to build a third or fourth party, to make that party viable, and then where do you think the electoral system will be in 10 years? So in other words, and I'll put this and I'll end here on this question. If I were to ask someone who wants to, say, rebuild the Green Party, let's just use the Green Party as the example. Are you telling me that it's going to take 10 years? I mean, what is it? I'm not going to be critical. I just want to know. Are you telling me it's going to take 5 to 10 years to build the Green Party up enough to where it has a viable shot at winning offices, at winning power in the electoral sphere? And if you're telling me that's going to take 5 or 10 years, and if you're telling me that the electoral system will continue on the same path that it's continued for the last 10 or 20 years, which is becoming more undemocratic, more corporate friendly, even less likely for progressive reform, then even by the time you're done creating a Green Party that's viable, the electoral system will be in a position that will be utterly incapable of providing the sort of reforms that you think you're going to get through those traditional mechanisms. And on top of that, in the context of runaway climate change and ecological devastation, we don't have 10 years to rebuild a third party just to win some seats in Congress. We don't have that time. And then we don't have another 5 or 10 years for that Green Party to build up the kind of hegemonic power it would need to push through the kind of progressive reforms that would be needed to curb the worst of climate disaster. So at this point in my life and in my sort of perspective of what's going on, yes, participate at the hyper-local level if you think there's elected offices that you can win and that it's not going to take you years and years to build the structures to win those things, then I say take that opportunity, do what you can, get your people in power. But I go back to Howard Zinn. I go back to sort of a fundamental different reading of history, and that is it doesn't matter who's sitting in office, to paraphrase the late, great Howard Zinn. It matters who's sitting in. And without radical, massive social movements, it doesn't matter if you have a Green Party candidate in power, a Democrat, a Republican, or otherwise. If we don't have radical unions that are mobilized and organized, and if we don't have radical social movements, I simply do not see us achieving anything that we need to achieve through the electoral sphere, especially in the time that it needs to be achieved by.
Yes, and I think we had just an example of that. I mean, in New York State, we elected for the first time more progressives to the legislature than ever before. Took the Senate back from the Republicans. We had a progressive assembly for a long time. And Andrew Cuomo and the legislature that just genuflected to him just passed probably the most horrendous budget, at least in my memory, especially within the context of a pandemic where Medicaid was slashed $2.5 billion and, you know, it was basically an austerity budget. So I take your point. I guess there are those who say it's not either or, that because mass movements have a certain amount of power, but unless they can actually take the reins of government, it's hard for them to accomplish the kinds of practical structural change that we need. And on the other hand, too, electoral movements that take power, we can see how just how quickly they can get compromised. So what do you think of that inside-outside idea?
I agree with you generally speaking. Generally speaking, I tell people I'm for all of the above. I don't think it's an either-or thing, though I do think, again, we need to do a serious, I'll put it this way. The way that I see it is if Bernie Sanders couldn't get the nomination, it's over with for the Democratic Party. There is no bench for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders was the last torchbearer for those politics in the Democratic Party. AOC has no shot in hell. Anyone who thinks people from the squad are going to get nominated as president are totally out of their minds and don't understand this country at all. I'm not even particularly impressed with people from the squad, to be honest with you. I think their politics are good, better than most, and not even close to what Bernie Sanders' politics are or what he represents in terms of that connection to the internationalist left, having ideas around international solidarity. I mean, Ilhan Omar has those politics to some degree, but there's 4 people in the Democratic Party who are worth anything, in my opinion. I mean, in a real fundamental way, not like, oh, Sherrod Brown does some good things for unions and trade deals. I mean, not that. I mean, people who genuinely represent something different, maybe a handful of people in the Democratic Party. There's no bench for Bernie Sanders. The Democratic Socialists of America, yes, they do have 60,000 members, but not enough to make an electoral impact around this country. I'm, like you, very impressed with what the folks at Jacobin have done, what other folks have done, but they do not have the kind of power to influence the Democratic Party in the way that we want them to, or the way that we would want to. So it's a tough question. I'm not, you know, to be quite honest with you, I'm not necessarily telling people not to participate, but the argument that I would make is that this is as good as it's going to get for the Democratic Party. That Bernie Sanders' 2020 run for the White House was as close as the left is ever going to get to getting power within the Democratic Party. And everything from here on out, now we'll see how this plays out. Maybe we can have a conversation a year from now and maybe tell me that I'm totally wrong. But I assume this is going to play out in very horrific ways for the Democrats. More people are not joining the party after 2020. I think you'll see Joe Biden get destroyed at the polls, and I think he'll lose far worse than Hillary Clinton lost. And in fact, I think he'll lose the popular vote this time around as well. I think after that happens, you'll see the Democratic Party in free fall mode. It was already in free fall mode after 2016. It reached its lowest point in 72 years, momentarily brought back the House with some centrist Democrats who haven't done anything for poor working class people since they got elected in 2018. And I fully expect the Republicans to run the floor with the Democrats in 2020. Unless something radically different happens with the way that the public is viewing Trump's response to this, and I've seen his poll numbers both go up and down during this process, there is no bench for Bernie Sanders, and there's no electoral body. In other words, the Democratic Party at every level is not capable of sort of taking over the party. So in Chicago and New York, it's still the Democratic machine that runs the show. In Los Angeles and San Francisco, it's still the Democratic machine that runs the show. It's not like in the biggest, most powerful metropolitan areas in the United States with the most powerful Democratic parties, it's still corporate Democrats who run the show. And until that changes, or until I see the kind of movement that I would need to see at the local level, at the regional, grassroots, state level, and that would, for me, include thousands of members joining the party, with, you know, precinct committeemen operating and local county officials organizing events and all of that, none of that is happening. I've never seen this least amount of activity during a presidential cycle since I've been involved. And again, I live in Indiana. Indiana went blue for the first time in 44 years in 2008. So the first time since 1964 that Indiana voted for a Democrat was for Barack Obama in 2008. 2 years later, the Tea Party swept everything. 2 years after that, Mitt Romney destroyed Barack Obama in Indiana. We've had hundreds of thousands of voters kicked off the rolls. The internal institutional problems within the electoral system, I think, are so deep and wide-ranging that they're almost impossible to discuss all at once. But that's sort of how I view the electoral situation. And again, that's not to say don't participate at all. If you have an opportunity, great. You know, hopefully we can, you know, get your person in office. Understanding that if your person gets into office, that they won't be able to make changes without that pressure from below. But also, we have to question how viable that strategy is as a nationwide strategy. In other words, it could look very different in New York State than it looks in Mississippi. And I'm assuming it will.
I guess some things that I would put up to ask you and counterpoint to that would be, first of all, a real shift of the Overton window to the left in general. I mean, think about how many decades it took the right wing to take over our politics. Of course, we don't have decades, but there's been a pretty swift movement in that. I mean, and I think we can thank not just Bernie Sanders, but also Occupy and all the other influence them. Just we can actually thank neoliberalism for that, because I think it's becoming very clear to a lot of people what the system is really about. And the other thing is the demographic change to young people, who were overwhelmingly for that kind of multiracial working class movement of solidarity.
I agree. I think the fundamental difference that I can see, and I think you see this, we don't even have to go back that far. I mean, look at just the last 10 years. the Republicans see their primary vehicle for political change being the Republican Party. I'm sorry, conservatives, right-wingers see their primary vehicle for political change being the Republican Party. As this conversation is sort of evidence to people, there is still a fundamental disagreement on the left as to what the vehicle is for fundamental political change. And I think we saw that after the Tea Party, where even if conservatives, right-wingers, reactionary types loathed their leadership within the party, they were solely focused on taking over that party. Right now, if you were to line up 10 of my best friends, maybe two of them are working within the Democratic Party, two of them are working on environmental issues through an NGO, two of them are working on a community group, two of them are members of a union, and two of them have a podcast. You know, I'm just using like examples. Like, there is not a uniform idea on the left or a consensus that the Democratic Party is the vehicle through which this change can happen. And I think that's the fundamental difference between where we're at today, where Reagan was at in 1980 with the Republican Party, and where the Republicans were in 2010.
Well, it's easy to take over a political party when your ideas serve the needs of the ruling class. Much more difficult to take over a political party when that political party is really in the grip of the corporate donor class. So let's...
No, that's a great point. That's a really, really great point. And I think that's true. I think that's objectively true. But I think amongst the activist class of both parties, like the folks within those parties are on the wings who are actually in the streets organizing, protesting, etc., there seems to be a consensus among the people within that party, or even the people who are activists and so forth within the Republican Party, that the party is the vehicle. And I just think it's objectively true what you said, but I don't think that it's true that we've come to the same conclusion as progressives, liberals, et cetera, leftists, that the Democratic Party is the vehicle through which that change is going to happen.
So that does bring us to the question, what is the vehicle? What do you envision is necessary going forward? Because as you point out in this really terrific article, The New Normal, Cascading and Multi-Layered Crises, Vincent Emanuele, you point out that it could go one of two ways. One could be a direction toward greater justice, and the other could be toward greater authoritarianism. And certainly if Trump wins, I'm not so sure we even have a field on which to take the fight for justice.
Well, I think we always have the ability to create and build mass movements. I think that's number one, and we're missing those. There's an inordinate amount of time and energy that people spend on electoral efforts with little to show for it. We here in Michigan City, Indiana, have a local community organization. That's not the answer, but I think it's a start. So the reason we opened our community cultural center in Michigan City was because over the years, we had found that traveling around the world, traveling around the country, working with different social movements, even revolutionary movements in some contexts, in some continents, it was clear that spaces served a primary function in their operation. So we don't have cultural spaces anymore. We don't have political spaces where people spend time together. One of the ironies, of course, is that we opened the space because we wanted people to spend more time together. And now we're relegated to doing everything online. And so I think having those spaces, creating those kinds of independent political organizations, that our community organization is not tied to the Democratic Party, it's not tied to any political party. I think developing those organizations is key. I think student groups need to organize. Campuses right now are not organized at the level that they could be, and I think they could be a particularly powerful force. And I think most importantly, and I think here, the union organizer Jane McAlevey's work is extremely important, and that is we need to rebuild the labor movement in the United States, that the primary mechanism through which poor and working class people have made serious gains in this country and have battled corporate power and capital is through collective organizing, through unions. Right now, that's a difficult task because I think somewhere between 10 or 11% of the population is unionized. But those are where I've seen some of the most positive developments. Here, we're talking about teacher strikes from Arizona to Kansas to Kentucky, even here in Indiana. So Chicago and so forth. You know, you can see this with nurses unions as well prior to the pandemic. And I think coming out of the pandemic, you're going to see nurses unions really, really at the forefront of this union struggle. And I think if you look back at the periods where we've made tremendous change in the United States, the 1880s, the 1930s, the 1960s, maybe less so in the 60s, but definitely in the 1880s, and of course in the 1930s, unions played a primary role. And I think there has yet to be an institution that's developed, and it's definitely not nonprofit organizations, that can serve the same function for poor and working class people that unions have. And I think if we have a historical reading of how these changes have happened throughout history, at the very center of that history is radical unionism. That's one option. Social movements are another option for people who are not involved with those union movements. The interplay between radical union movements, social movements, student movements. And at some point, I am reluctant to use this term because experiencing what it's like to live in a violent context, being at war, being to different failed states and seeing what they look like, the last thing that I think we want here is any kind of violence. And I don't think that you have to have violence inherently wrapped up in this concept of revolution. But I do think that peaceful, nonviolent, massive protest movements, to your point, how do we get these people out of power? I don't think it's through 10 years of trying to get them elected out of power or voting them out of power. I think it's thousands and thousands of people shutting down businesses as usual, unions and workers shutting down businesses and forcing people to resign from office and putting people in power that we want in power. And I think over time, we're going to see these institutions continue to deteriorate and continue to become more and more corrupt. And I think the options for people will become increasingly limited. So I think if people are disenchanted with the democratic process this time around, I think by 2024, they'll be even more so, and then so on and so forth. And I think at some point that's going to leave people with very limited options. And those options will include organizing in your community, organizing at your workplace, and then connecting with other organizations and people throughout the region, country, and world. I think those are the types of things that leftist progressives should be thinking about right now. And again, I think revisiting history and looking at what are the sort of mechanisms that created significant political power. So it wasn't that FDR was just a good guy. It was that millions of socialists and union organizers and workers around the country were willing to shut down the country unless they got what they wanted. And I think we see this even with a Republican in power, where, you know, people joke that Richard Nixon was sort of the last liberal president that we've had in this country. I mean, you know, the left forced Richard Nixon to create the EPA. These are the kinds of things that happen when you have the kind of power in the streets and the power at the workplace that you need to shut down business as usual. I mean, in this context, it seems even more clear to me that right now people aren't going to get what they want through simply showing up to the ballot box, that from now until November, you know, workers have to decide how are they going to organize to get the things they want, knowing that, you know, we have many, many, many months until an election. So, and there's, you know, these elections come around every 2 or 4 years. In the meantime, there's 364 days of the year. What does that organizing look like?
Well, Vincent Emanuele, this has just been very important and fascinating discussion stemming from your article, The New Normal, Cascading and Multilayered Crises. I highly recommend it to my listeners. It's on Counterpunch. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca. I really appreciate the time, and it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Vincent Emanuele's article for Counterpunch is The New Normal, Cascading and Multilayered Crises. Go to writersvoice.net. to find a link. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.